Mr. Jewett, Reel 20. You went to Chatham. What kind of things were you learning or being taught in Chatham and this gunnery school?
In the gunnery school, it's one of these places. It's just like Whale Island, this famous Whale Island of Portsmouth. I mean, Chatham, I think, probably worse, because they're always trying to outdo Whale Island. But it's a part of the main barracks, and it's got its own drill square, and it is what it says. It's a school for various aspects of naval gunnery. All examples, and they have every modern gun there which you can imagine. Later on, I was to become a gunnery instructor, but for now, I was just a third class rate, and I was taking range, and that was my job actually, as a range taker. And they have what they call RIPERS, roll, yaw, and pitch of the ship, RIPER equipment. So all these range finders were mounted on hydraulic contraptions which used to roll all over the place. It's just like being at sea, and you had to take ranges on various things. It was all fudged up sort of thing, and you could, but it was very, very good training, because you had to spend hours on these things, and you got marked on them. Because obviously if you didn't get a sufficiently high mark, you didn't get your badge, you didn't get your pay and that, so you wasted everybody's time. So it was all about there's an old naval saying, bullshit baffles brains, and it was all about marching here and marching there, the discipline and marching there. Everywhere you went, you marched, you know, arms at length. You didn't walk, you marched, and everything was there. And the gunnery school was holy ground, actually. It was one of those places you kept away from if you had any sense, unless you were, of course, a qualifying class. And you joined up in a class, and your class leader, whoever it would be responsible for the class. And then by your instructors, all GIs, gunnery instructors, who used to take a really good number. Yeah.
And your fellow students, were they
able seamen,
experienced men like yourself?
That's right, yeah, mostly. Yeah. Most able seamen come in. And they'd all be sent to different ships, you know. But you would go there specifically as a CR, as a control rating, you know.
How long was the course?
The course for me was only about a month, I think. That's all, the first time. About a month, yeah. It was about a month, actually.
So that you wouldn't have much time for anything else, really.
You had divisions, and you were at school all day. There was nothing else but school at the gunnery school while you were there. And then the gunnery school closed at 4 o'clock, and that gave you time to go back and get your tea and get changed to go ashore, you see. And in the gunnery school, you had four watches: red, white, and blue, and yellow. And you get that when you join the barracks. You're given a card, the same as any other ship. You know exactly where you stand for the moment you go into it. And you were duty watch sometimes. I mean, sometimes you couldn't go ashore every night. But it wasn't that pleasant, because you had to go every night at sundown. You had to take your hammock, carry your hammock across to the tunnel. There was huge tunnels underground. That was for aircraft, air raid, because quite obviously they were a fair target. A naval barracks is obvious, and how they didn't plaster it. I mean, they're that busy knocking the stuffing out of the poor civilians of London, when they could have done 50 times more damage if they'd bombarded a place like Chatham Barracks, which was a dockyard as well. It's not only a barracks, but a huge naval dockyard. So why they didn't, I mean, it was unbelievable of course, that's how we won the war, wasn't it? Because they did daft things just like us.
What time date were you undertaking this course?
By now, crumbs, I'd have to look at my gunnery history sheet. I can get it for you if you like.
Sicily was July 43, so, and you came home, so...
Just hold on a minute. The date was be around June 1943, actually. Now, of course, I was in barracks this time, as I said, and of course I was experiencing some of the bombing on London at that, South East London that particular time. As I said, it was the crazy Germans were doing it that way. So then I was now a Killick, and I got a draft on the roundabout, it's a bit later than that, but July, I got a draft to HMS Vigilant. And I went to the Vigilant on the 30th of August in 1943, that's when I went there. So it was on the Vigilant that...
Where did you join her?
Now, the Vigilant was one of the new V and W class destroyers, not as powerful as the Ashanti. I think I've got a couple of the Vigilant. I've got a picture of the Vigilant, and she's got a single 4.7 guns and both those guns, and they had both of guns crews and close range. They were quite nice ships actually. They mass produced the V and W's, and I joined her at Wall's End. At Newcastle, you see. So this is the second time that I've come back to Wall's End, Swanhunter, Wigham Richardson's yard at Wall's End, and I've come back to Newcastle again, which must have been my fate. So here I am in Wall's End shipyard, Swanhunter's, and I was commissioned this brand new fleet class destroyer called HMS Vigilant. And of course everybody said, the rumour was that we were going to the Med, to join the Med fleet. And of course when I got aboard I was appalled to find that everybody in my mess, because I was a leading seaman now, were what they call HOs, hostilities only. And during the period of the war, the whole personnel situation had reversed. When at the beginning of the war we were all professionals, but now they were all amateurs, and it was just very few professionals like me were scattered about among the ships. And it was only about two or three of us who were real professionals actually on the Vigilant, and I was one of them. Well, all these youngsters. It was terribly dangerous. Everybody was saying, they were bringing all this tropical gear, they were making a big show of bringing all this tropical equipment abroad, you see, aboard the ship, loading it on, you see. And it's big on the side, tropical equipment, and all that. So they're all getting loaded on. And I got aboard, and I looked, and they were sitting down. They said, "Well, we're going out. Looks as if we're going out the Med or the Far East." I said, "You're not, you know. How do you know? I'm telling you, you're not going." And I knew that we weren't. Right from the first, I knew, and I'll tell you why, because of the very extensive lagging that was round all the pipes, and all everywhere was heavily laden with lagging and extra insulation on everything, wherever you looked there was lagging. And I thought, and I recognised that, you don't have this when you're going to the Far East or to the, this is, I know where we're going, Russia it was. So I didn't say anything.
Who was your new captain?
A fella called Argles. His name was Argles. He was a nice enough fella, but it was a personal thing. Apparently he was a really good bloke. He became an admiral, but I didn't gel with him somehow. I think it was because I'm one of these people that's so loyal, I get attached to people, and I can't find myself finding the same sort of attachment with the next person. I can't I'm sort of like that. I can't help that.
First officer, who was that?
I can't remember the name of the officers of that ship so much. I've never really, for some reason or other, the Vigilant and I didn't altogether gel. Not the same as the Ashanti. I think it was because of the Ashanti, really, because it was such a great ship and all crack hands. I'll give you an example. I was a coxswain of the whaler. A coxswain of the motor cutter, and this Killick's of we had a, all these I had to teach all these sailors, bends and hitches, you know, how to tie a boat to a Jacob's ladder and things like that. And they didn't know what a lazy painter was from a painter. They hadn't a clue. And I had to teach them all this, you know, because some of these kids had been bank clerks and woodworkers, and they'd been called up, you see, and here I was, 6 weeks ago, they'd been sitting in Barclays Bank, you know, and here am I, they're going to battle, going up to Russia to fight the Germans in a warship. I thought, God, bloody hell. Anyway, the next working up, the working up period is about 6 months, 6 weeks rather. And in the working up period, meant an awful lot of teaching how to marry boats, fools, and the chief boatswain's mate, he was another professional. And we all had a rough time trying, and the POs and that, had a rough time trying to lick this ship's company of amateurs into shape. But we did, and they were as good as anything. They were actually, they were just as good as us at the end of the day, you know, they were good lads. And they were a fine ship's company. And what happened, I took two or three convoys to Russia, and I was hardened to it, you know, I was well hardened to it, and I wasn't, least bit, it was news to these kids, they were a bit frightened, and I think I must have been a very steadying influence, because I was so, by now, I was a real hardened veteran, you know, I wasn't worried at all. And I think it must have been, you know, they probably thought, well, if he can be like that, so can I, sort of thing. I think might have helped a lot. I don't like to, I like to think so. But I was a range taker on the, I was on the Beaufort gun's crew, actually, because she was a good, but they had a range finder on this thing, absolutely useless bloody thing it was, a 1 meter base range finder, and they used a damned ornament, an idiot that thought that up, knew practically nothing about firing action stations, what have you. Might have been all right for the army, but no good for naval work. So then I came to, I was range taker full time, because I was a better range finder than their proper one, and somehow or other they got rid of him. Oh, it was a fellow called Brown, that's right, he was the gunnery officer, and Brown knew that I knew my stuff, and he had me up in the rangefinder.
Were some of the officers also hostile only men?
Oh yeah, because you can tell the hostilities only. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were wavy navy, you know. They were sort of RNR, what they call wavy navy, and they got rocky. Whereas the full time officers had complete bands, so we didn't get many of those. Actually, they were nearly all wavy navy now. So anyway, I got the next thing. Took two or three. The next big thing which we did on the Vigilant was, believe it or not, was D-Day.
So again, you had Russian convoys.
Russian convoys. All the nothing else. That's what we would do.
But not outstanding at all.
Not at all. No. That there was by now, Russian convoys weren't as sort of the things had cooled down a bit. You know, they weren't quite as bad as they were. In the early days, you lost a lot of ships and that, and all the rest of it, but there weren't any of the big significant battles that I can recall that we had in the early days, the early Russian convoys.
And the crew, you say, obviously settled in and picked up and became a first-class crew.
Yes, they did. They did, very quickly. They assimilated it very, very quickly. But they had to, you know.
The quality of the people that you were getting from civilian life... intellectually,
Was it good? Oh, it was a cross section. You've got some very, very bright lads, and you've got some right perks as well. You know, you really did. I mean, some of them, they hadn't the training that we had, and you had to be sort of strict on them for cleanliness to start with. You know, they didn't realise that they had to live with other people, and you've got to keep clean. Things like that, which are. They had to be instilled on them. I was really hard on my mess, and they appreciated it. I met them after the war, and they told me how much they appreciated it when they started realising the things that I'd taught them. But it was No, they were good lads. There were a cross section. There were all sorts. There was teachers, and there weren't many policemen actually. I didn't meet many policemen. But we got reporters, you know, hacks, you know, all sorts. One or two reporters came our way, and there was one or two people from colleges, you know, and universities. There was quite a cross section. They come from all, you know, when they get called up, that's it. They're just a numbers sort of thing in the draft sheets. They're no respecters of persons.
Were ships at this time being adopted by towns and cities in the country?
No, well, the Vigilant was. The Ashanti wasn't either. No, she wasn't actually. She wasn't adopted by anybody. The only was the place. It was Ashanti land, you know, the Asahanti that adopted, and they called Auntie May. But now Auntie May was only for the tribals. Not for the I told you about
yes,
Auntie May.
Yeah,
but not for the Vigilant. No. The Vigilant was a different thing.
So the Vigilant was adopted by who?
I don't know. I don't know that we were ever.
Did it mean anything being adopted by a
well, it did, well, it didn't worry as much because we weren't, if you know what I mean. But it would have been very very nice if we had been. But not that, to my knowledge, while I was on the Ashanti, while I was on the Vigilant, because I wasn't on the Vigilant that long, because. The Vigilant was after D-Day. I think we come.
Yes,
down
you,
to
as you said, you left. You left the Russian convoys, and now it's yeah, D-Day preparation time.
That's right. We were preparing for D-Day. We went down south. We went down to Devonport and Portsmouth, and we were based down there from then onwards. We were preparing for D-Day, and it was Army cooperation bombardment, and it was quite interesting. And of course you know the date of D-Day by now is 1944, wasn't it? It was coming around about there, 1944, that's right. And I was a range taker then, by then, and got my and I had a position, I can't remember the name, was it Sword Piece? We were in the British sector, and I can always remember because of this house, this isolated house, which was in my sights all the time, in my wonderful range finder.
What was the training for? Did you go through some training process?
No, not at all. Actually, I was a ship's postman actually as well as at this time, and we anchored off a place called Sea View in the Isle of Wight. I don't know if you know the Isle of Wight, but I don't know exactly where it is, but we anchored off a place called Sea View, and I went ashore there, and I was the only person allowed ashore. I was a ship's postman. All the ship's company, before D-Day, about 4 or 5 days, were incarcerated on the ship. There was no going ashore at all, except one person. That was the postman, to collect the mail and deliver it. And that's what I did. I delivered the mail and collected it. And it went to the FM. I was very, very efficient. The Fleet Mail Office and all had to take it ashore at Sea View. Well, I took it ashore in the morning. I took the mail ashore in the morning. And I had all day long to do nothing. I had nothing to do all day. I had to lounge around. Weather wasn't bad at all. And I had to lounge around on the beaches. Look, there were other ships' postmen from other ships there as well, who were just the same as me. They couldn't do a thing. We had to go and collect the mail to take it back aboard the ship at night time. Then we were back on the ship again. And then the following day, we'd collect the ship's mail for sure, and that was my job. Believe it or not, that's all I could do. So, because they didn't come and collect me after they left me there to all day long. So that was what I did before D-Day.
Did you know this period in time that it was D-Day?
Oh, everybody put it together. Yes, everybody did. I mean, you didn't tell us, but you didn't need to be any intelligence whatever to work out where there's so many these ships all together. Like, I'm talking about dozens of them, like, you know, and big ships, small ships, whatever. And how the Germans didn't put it together, I'd never know, but we did. Yeah. I mean, it was
you must
obvious.
Have seen this build-up along the coast.
Yes, I think what had happened, I think they'd fooled the Germans because they'd been putting ships down there quite a number of ships, so that there was nothing special, you know. There wasn't overnight. it wasn't an overnight, it was done over a period, you know, that we were building up, you know. As I said, we came along from Devonport, and I remember going ashore in Portsmouth, and at Aggie Westerns. We slept at Aggie Westerns, you know, that's the naval home, and we'd dance there, I think, in Portsmouth, and it was quite nice, actually. Yeah. But just before D-Day, a matter of a few days, it was only, we're talking about days, you know, and then we went to to the Isle of Wight, and I went to a place. During the day, I used to go to Ryde. I went to Ryde. I went to Seaview. I can't remember all the places I went to now. But that's what the routine was until. And I understand now. I didn't know then that D-Day had been postponed for 24 hours. But we didn't know that, did we? And so, but anyway, the day came. We set off across the...
Where did you sail from?
I actually sailed from Seaview, from the Isle of Wight. That's where we went from.
And other ships with you?
Oh, yes. Hundreds of dozens. There were absolutely dozens. There were literally dozens and dozens. I wouldn't say hundreds, but there were dozens of ships. There were tank landing crafts and the big ships, but... They came after us. We went in first, you know. The destroyers were always the first into the field. And we lay off, and coming in towards
D-Day. Can I just ask?
Yeah.
You've sailed, and this is the moment.
Yeah.
Once you put to sea, once you sailed, did the captain speak to you to tell you what was going to go
on? Oh, yes, he did. Our captain did, as a matter of fact. He said that he said, we're now... going into action to land our troops on French soil, and good luck to you all, and that sort of thing. That's what they always say, you know. And we set about our action stations.
That must have been quite a moment.
Well, it was in a way. But for me personally, I think the truth was, it probably would have been for anybody who hadn't been before, but I'd been, you know, sort of through the middle. It was just another set to whatever happened. It was another here we go again sort of thing, you know.
What condition was the sea?
It was choppy. It wasn't rough. It wasn't rough at all. It wasn't smooth either. It was choppy. It was quite choppy, and I always remember that. And there were one or two lone raiders, one or two, but not many. I think about two or three, I think, the most we ever saw of the German Air Force, because the RAF completely monopolised the sky. That was the wonderful part about it. I mean, if you haven't been in an action unless you've... I mean, if without air cover, and that's when you know all about it, because they plaster you, you know. But no, we had an easy passage, I'll be honest about that, I reckon. So that we all got to be... We sailed in, and laying off... The first thing I'd ever seen, the RAF went in before us, and because remember I had these wonderful sight. They dropped, and it was green coming down. They dropped these thousands and thousands of green, like all along the coast, all along the whole length of the coast, was this green stuff coming down. And then as soon as it touched the ground, it went up in flames. It was fluorescent, you know, phosphorus, they were dropping phosphorus bombs. And it was an inferno, you know. So how we were supposed to sort out any targets, I do not know. But my ship's job then was to go in, and we had what we called sector firing, and they came up from the plotting room and told us what the angle of elevation was, and I was just watching through my the guns were controlled from the transmitting station, but I was watching because of the I could range, you see. And we lay off for I suppose about 4,000 yards. We were which is no distance, actually.
Was this night or
daytime? No, dawn. Dawn. You know, it started as dawn. Yes, we sailed over during the night, and we got there bang on time. You know, it was dawn coming up. And the break of dawn, and I think about 5 o'clock, I think it was, going from memory. I think it was about 5 o'clock. And there was a countdown again, you know, five, you know, the countdown to open fire.
And you'd take stations, presumably, in
action stations. Oh, the ship did, port. Yes. Every ship was allocated a particular station. It wasn't a free-for-all, no, by no means. You had to take your own particular station, because you had your own sector, you see. Sometimes we were firing in positions that we didn't know what the hell we were firing at, but they did, but we didn't. All we did was fire guns, and the produce were landed probably about 5 or 6 miles or more inland, where we didn't know what the hell. That was, you know, sector firing is like that. You see, you don't see a target. You just set your guns are set at a certain angle, and you fire them, and you say, well, goodbye. You don't know where the hell that prod is going to land. The people in control know, but you don't. That was one of the.
It's like firing on fixed lines, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It's all set by mathematics, and you know, they know exactly where you were, because each ship had its own station, you see.
The layout of the ships, as presumably the destroyers were at nearest to the coast.
That's right.
And then your bigger
cruisers and battleships further out, that's right, because they laid off. I mean, we weren't much good. The battleships, I didn't see this, but I know I was told about it, was the when they, these big German guns, you know, gun emplacements, the concrete things weighing all several hundred tons. Well, the only thing that could shift those, I mean, they were, we'd fired them, they bounced off, you know, pea shooters, you might as well have spit at them with all the good. But the battleships now, this is where the battleships beat the RAF. Now, the RAF had bombed these turrets, these gun turrets, to blazes, but they had about 6 feet of concrete to get through, reinforced concrete above, and the Germans knew that. And there was no way that those bombs were going to make the slightest impression. But what beat them was the 15-inch shells that got underneath and lifted them out. That was what fettled them. They were useless. When the big battleships fired a broadside, and they just literally turned them out. They just blew them sky from underneath, not from the top, because the top was that was one of those interesting things.
Was there any gunfire coming back?
No, not a thing. No, no. But the poor old soldiers would get it with closer machine guns and things. I saw them through my range taker. I could see these lads, as if it was 20 yards in front of me, going into battle. You know, I could see the tank landing shafts. I could see them going in. I could see the soldiers going up the beach. And there was a big house. I can remember every summer, see D-Day, I see this house. And I thought, well, this blooming house on its own was where I was. You know, I could see it. And I could see these soldiers going up. And I could see some of them falling down on the way. And a poor soldier. You know. I had a grandstand view completely
The craft carrying the soldiers must have sailed through you.
That's right. They were through. That's right. They were because there would be.
That must have been quite a sight.
Yes, that's right. It was. It was an unbelievable thing. It was a sight you don't forget in a hurry, sort of thing. And that from then onwards, of course, once the landing was made, that was sort of the end. As far as apart from anti-aircraft or something like, or army cooperation, a further army cooperation board when they contacted the ship, and we did cooperation.
You had short the ship contact.
There was, yes, I think wireless contact. I'm not phone.
Was this the time that there were naval observers, gun observers?
That's right. That's right.